then no ballon is required. The unbalanced coaxial cable, the shield would go to the boom, so to speak, of the Yagi. The center conductor would go to the ballon structure, the gamma rod structure. And so there is an unbalanced antenna with an unbalanced feed that's perfectly compatible. You could put a ballon in there if you wanted to. It would make no difference as long as the ballon had reasonable performance and not a whole lot of insertion loss. If you are now feeding a folded dipole, thoroughly balanced driven element of a Yagi-like antenna, and you just simply connect your coax cable directly to it, you're now going to end up with some RF energy on the outside of the shield of the coax cable. And the length of the coax cable is now part of the resonance of the driven element, the dipole on that Yagi. There's all kinds of combinations of with and without balance, with and without balanced antennas. Let me try. And whether or not your antenna is a thoroughly balanced driven element, partially balanced driven element, or a thoroughly unbalanced driven element, I mean, there's various ways. In the case of a ground plane antenna, a station master-like antenna, a collinear antenna, where you're feeding one end of that antenna, and you'd like to be feeding it against an infinite ground plane, and all you've got is three little ground plane radios coming out of the bottom of the antenna at a 45 degree angle. As poor as that looks to the uncalibrated eye, that is a beautiful antenna that does a beautiful job of taking an unbalanced coax cable going in, and those three little ground plane radials at the bottom do all that's required, partially because of the fact that you're feeding the outer end of that resonating structure where the impedance is very high, and therefore you don't need a 5 ohm equivalent resistance to that ground plane. If the end of the antenna you're feeding is a, let me pick a number, 1,000 ohm impedance, then a fairly mediocre ground plane can do the job. So there's lots and lots of mixtures of how much need is there for a ballon, how much grief do you run into without it, and there's lots of combinations here. N2XJN, K2LIW, the TechNet.
N2XJN. So, which one of the factors would you assign to the power circuit? Say, first, the impedances of each conductor to the reference plane are equal. Second would be a balance is not defined by voltage or current. And the third one, imbalance impedances cause unbalanced currents. Interaction.
If you have the wrong combination, like a coax cable directly fit to a dipole, it's not going to crash and burn, but it's a less than ideal situation. You're going to have RF energy flowing back down the outside of the coax cable, and only putting in some kind of a ballon, a real unidella ballon or poor man's equivalent, five turns of coax cable in a 1.5 foot diameter circle near the dipole, creates an RF choke, which is a poor man's ballon, and it does 95% of what you want. In most cases, it's good enough. So which antennas really require a ballon, and how much grief do you get into if you don't use one? And there are antennas that don't require a ballon. That's a whole fairly complicated subject to some people. If you're working in the antenna design situation, let me drop. You have a whole bunch of rules of thumb and gut feel as to what's required and how much grief you get into if you bypass it. In almost all of these situations, as I said, it's not going to crash and burn. You can do it the wrong way, the quick and dirty way, and you're on the air. And at some later time, you make an improvement as you understand the problem, as you study it, and you read the right articles. As I said before, that the best way of looking at an ideal ballon is an isolation transformer with a thoroughly floating secondary winding. And some people will call this ballon a current ballon, a balanced current ballon. Some of these will call the others a balanced voltage ballon. If you really had a secondary winding of a transformer with a center tap, and you grounded the center tap, most people will call that a balanced voltage feeding method. If the center conductor is thoroughly floating, and there's no center conductor at all, most people will call it a current ballon. These are relativistic words. The actual voltage across the two T terminal, the two ends of that secondary winding of that theoretical transformer. That voltage is essentially fixed. Let me drop. Okay, well recognized. So you could say that the voltage across the two ends of the secondary winding, it's producing an exact amount of voltage? Yes. It's producing an exact amount of current? No. Only when you put a load resistor there. As you vary the load resistor, the current changes. Is it a current feed? Is it a voltage feed? It gets complicated, and there's lots of misunderstanding of all these words. KE2EJ, K2LAW, he's about to clear this all up for us, because you've used some very high balance in your days. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, you started off talking about a Yagi with gamma net, so, I mean, there's more to that than HCI. I mean, now you're bringing to a balanced set of driven elements on Yagi, but isn't it natural impedance of a Yagi? I don't know if you're trying to set it up for the best front to back, don't you wind up with an impedance that's considerably lower than 50 ohms? What do you recommend in terms of the balance? Because now you're talking about balance, it's complete isolation, yet you may not make the impedance match, because from what I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, some of the Yagis that I was playing with, something like 20, 25 ohms.
You're exactly right, Eric. If I take an ordinary dipole like you and I are likely to build on 80 meters, 132 feet long, insulator in the center, I feed the center, and I make some careful measurements, I'll find something in the vicinity of 72 ohms. Now let's make believe I'm building a 20 meter equivalent of that dipole, which I think is 16 feet on each side, 32 feet total, in that order. And so, the dipole all by itself in natural air, 73 ohms. Put that dipole in the middle of parasitic elements of a Yagi. And now there's a big variation. Almost all of them come down in ohms, depending on which Yagi design you use. How close is that first director and so on. Around 20 to 25 ohms is a typical impedance of that dipole. There are some Yagi designs where it comes down as low as 10 ohms. That's if you are feeding the center of a dipole in that Yagi. Almost nobody feeds a Yagi dipole that way. They're almost always going to use a gamma rod, a folded dipole structure, a delta match, various other techniques to do impedance variation, because the center of that dipole, if it was a split dipole and you're feeding it that way, you'd live with something in the vicinity of 20 to 25 ohms, and it's a little bit difficult to live with. You could buy a 2-to-1 balun with inverse impedance. In other words, most of the... Let me drop it. Many of the baluns you and I buy are 1-to-1, and you can buy a 2-to-1, a 4-to-1, and they almost always have a higher impedance on the output. I don't remember seeing a balun I could buy where the output impedance is lower than 50 ohms, although I'm sure it exists. Yeah, I think KLM has made some kind of a structure like that. So, because we rarely feed the center of a split dipole in the case of a Yagi, this becomes a little bit academic, and the gamma rod, as bad as it sounds, you're saying that, hey, this is an unsymmetric feed, I'm only feeding the right side. Therefore, you assume the right side of that driven element is going to have a lot more energy than the left side. Good guess, wrong. Let me drop. Almost every dipole radiates its signal by only 5% of the signal is radiated on each pass of the RF down the length of the dipole. That RF energy you're applying, to the dipole bounces back and forth 10 or 20 times in that resonator that you and I call dipole before it gets radiated. The fact you're only feeding one side of it doesn't matter. 95% of the energy is reflecting energy bouncing back and forth. You're adding 5% on each pass. A little similar to what happens when you're pushing your child on a swing. You only push her forward. You don't pull her backwards. You're not doing a symmetric feed. But because the Q of the structure is so high, the fact you're only feeding one side doesn't matter. The resonant energy of that swing is 95% of what's going on. You're just adding a little bit of energy on each push of each cycle. That's really what's happening with the dipole of that driven element. So feeding one half is not necessarily bad. It could be very good. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's just just hearing what you had to say about it that brought the thought into my mind. Because I mean, actually, somebody had approached me with a problem like this years back. You know, I've never seen now I'm going to go the other way. But for the experiment, we made our own, so that's what kind of reminded me of it. It's RIWK239.
The closest we come to feeding the center of the dipole of a driven element of a Yagi is the so-called hairpin feed technique. That's where you make the dipole shorter than length of resonance. You make up the missing length with this hairpin across the center, which really is a series inductor. And now you're feeding energy across that series inductor. The hairpin brings it all back into resonance. But the length of the hairpin and the ratio of length of hairpin to length of dipole can give you any impedance you want at the center. You can make that center impedance anything from 20 ohms to 300 ohms by just choosing the right length of hairpin and the right length of the dipole itself to compensate, to bring it back into resonance. So that very simple-looking structure is really quite sophisticated. And if you want to find out what you're really doing, by the way you've laid out that hairpin, you go to the right reference manual, you'll find out how many nanohenries or microhenries of inductance you've just created. You go to the Brown and Woodward curves in Chapter 4 of any issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, where you take the natural length of the radiating dipole itself, you know exactly what impedance you're feeding, therefore how much inductance you've got to add in order to bring it back into resonance. So it's all quantifiable with very good empirical data, real hard measured data, not somebody's fancy equation that's trying to do a data match across certain portions of the real data. These equations that people come up with, which do data matching, cubic spline approximations and so forth, are very simple dipoles, like a dipole. It's a huge, complicated equation, and you'd like to believe it's somebody's beautiful theoretical derivation using Maxwell's equations. Absolutely not. It's a curve matching equation where he's matched some of the data that's on the Brown and Woodward curves, and he thought the other data down at the bottom of the curves was useless because that's where the Q was so low and the radiator was so fat. For VHF, UHF antennas, that's an extremely valuable area that has been ignored for the last 60 years, 80 years. And by way of the patents I've been working on, I'm bringing that to light. People are saying, wow, how did we ignore that all this time? Okay, we did have Rich N2EO sign in last week. We didn't hear him, sorry to say. And Rich, go right ahead this week. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Jacob, Tukio, thank you for not forgetting about me. Wanted to comment on, I think you know, and maybe other people would like to know, I contacted Woody. K2UU puts up antennas professionally for hams. That's a new commercial, and that's a rare bird. He's a professional antenna rigger for hams. And Dick, all I can say is he hasn't been here yet, but I get a very good feeling about him. I sent him out a Cushcraft R8 sitting in my basement, brand new. Doesn't go down to 80 meters. He said, maybe I give up 80. He says to me, I don't want you to give up anything. And it turns out Cushcraft came out with an R9. Same antenna, but covers 80 meters. He told me that the former head engineer for Cushcraft, I'm sure you know him, Joe Reiser, W1JR, and he's going to contact Joe and find out if we can get the extra parts to turn the R8 into an R9. You know, I need Woody because, I don't know, I think most people know, a few years ago I became an amputee. I'm in a wheelchair. So I really appreciate the help Woody is going to give me back to that.
Very fine, Rich. I think I am one of the people who suggested Woody to you about a week or two or three ago. And I was supposed to get back to you with his phone number, but he's well-listed in all kinds of places. I sat in Woody's basement for about 3 hours one Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon, about 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And we were telling each other war stories about our tower installations. And he started opening up his spiral ring notebooks of where he got photographs of all the ham radio installations he has worked on in the last 30 years. And he's got pictures of all of them, and some of these are really significant installations, and some of them are very minor installations. Let me drop them. For 30 years. And he goes to put up a pair of 200-foot towers, Rhone 55 or Rhone 65, side by side, and one is the gin pole for the other, so that I can operate this winch where the 200-foot high tower can be tilted over to the ground. I put antennas on it, non-telescoping, tilting over. Those installations he has worked on. You look at these spiral ring notebooks, and they fill up a bookshelf of all the photographs of all of the antennas he's worked on for various amateurs. When it comes to wild installations done with good mechanical engineering, he's the man. When you're in his yard, let me drop it. You will see three, count them, three fully enclosed trailers, class three trailers, where each trailer is filled up with safety equipment, welding equipment, lathe equipment, drill press equipment, and whatever. He chooses the right trailer to tow it to the right installation for the kind of installation he's doing for an amateur. As you said, he's one in a million, one unusual guy. And so, if I had to make a guess, he has installed at least 5,000 installations, everything from relatively simple for my good buddy K2OBS out in Laurel, Long Island, on the North Shore, up to some of these installations that, except for the fact that the guy owns a couple of acres and can do it, and he's a retired guy with some extra money, I mean, they look like commercial installations, and even the commercial guys didn't have the chutzpah to go that far, pushing the state-of-the-art of mechanical engineering to do things like that. He has, I don't know how many crank-up towers in the backyard ready to roll, how many standing towers ready to roll, and so on. Lots and lots of hardware. He's your tower man. He's your antenna installation guy. You got the right guy. N2EO, I think you're going to be happy with that arrangement. K2I, and let him steer you as to what he can do for you. Don't, as I said, and you're already doing it. Let me drop it. You were starting to tell me, I want him to do this with that antenna, and I want him to do that with that antenna. Well, tell him what you got. Let him select the right way of getting you the most bang for the dollar, or the most bang per acre of property out of your particular property to put up antennas to cover whatever is your favorite ham band. Let him do some of the steering, as you were already doing. N2EO, you chose the right guy. K2IW, the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. I'm not telling him anything. Yeah. I'll let him tell me that I do own the Cushcraft R8, brand new in the box, or maybe I'll go with a high tower, which is a high gain, quarter wave, 80, 10 meter vertical. They're just two things I'm thinking of. Anyway, when I have to go into the hospital again, and he said to me, when I get back, give him another ring, he'll stop by and take a look. He sounds like a very nice gentleman. And all I can say is my initial opinion, he didn't brush me off. I would recommend him to anybody.
Yeah, I think you guys are about to have a good relationship. And there's a whole lot of people out there, living and dead, who will say some very pleasant words about Woody. I don't think I've ever met a ham who said something derogatory about that particular individual. So you got it made. Good luck with that installation, Rich. Okay, John, I wonder if these guys that mail you these really wild letters are going to stump us again tonight. Casey, and by the way, as they did with reference to an explanation for skin effect, and Roy did give me some further information on that. Unfortunately, although he's traceable to the Bureau and damn good data, it's not in a nice, easy form that you and I can express over the air to get people to understand where skin effect is coming from. I've got a mental image of a way of explaining it, which is not exactly traceable to the Bureau, but it may help. After we go through your questions, I'm going to throw in a couple of the words of what I thought of about this week, of where skin depth is coming from. KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2 with the call net.
Go ahead, Al.
About 13 GU, ready to assist Canada, and they're ready for over 25 years. This man is a professional at what he does. He's got my approval.
That particular rig you're using right now, Hal, is putting out nearly pure square waves. Your amount of audio is 10 decibels too loud for that particular rig. That volume control must have slipped on you on that one. We barely understood what you said. I can tell you're saying something very positive about K2UU. K6DPZ, K2LIW right now.
Nick, is this better?
Oh, boy. Only 2,000% better. Please proceed. You got it, Hal.
QRIW, the TechNet, K6DPC. I just want to say I know Woody for almost 25, 30 years. First cabin, he's a specialist in what he does, and there's nobody finer on the East Coast that does the dental work. That's my thing about Woody. We're very good friends.
Well done, Hal. Rich, you got it. N2EO, K2LIW.
Hey, Dick, one thing I didn't ask Woody, I'm a little confused. Maybe you know. He said Joe Weiser was the engineer for Kurzkraft, but I thought Walter Dabo-Ean was. Do you know anything about that?
Oh boy, is there a story there. We take almost every single serious VHF-er in New England. I could give you a long list of names. They have all worked for Joe Cushman at Cushcraft Antennas for approximately 1 to 1.5 years only. Went through a whole lot of individual guys. There's a lot of guesses as to what was taking place. Joe Reisert was there for 1.5 years. Dave O'Lean was there for about 1 year. AF1T was there for a certain period of time. There's a whole list of guys that worked for him for a certain short period of time. So it's a good apprenticeship. It's a good school of a particular kind of how to run a particular kind of antenna company. And why they left, why they were asked to leave, or why they decided to leave, why they didn't last very long, there's a bunch of guesses I've got going there. So name anybody who is a big name in VHF in New England, and there's a 50-50 chance that for a short period of time, he worked for the Cushman Antenna Company, Cushcraft Antenna Company. Back to the mailbag. Go right ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Paul, everyone on the net. Yes, slow week this week, but also I have kicked around that question of skin effect, and maybe on the phone we'll have a conversation about that. A lot of good stuff there. All right, I have a gentleman who's asking a pretty good question. Yagi antennas. He notices where the boom mounting bracket, the U-bolt that goes onto the mast, is located on most of these Yagis. Is not at the balance weight position. Is it located more toward the reflectors or wind balance? What is wrong with the location as a fulcrum of perfect balance for weight to begin with? Why don't they do that? And why is it always toward the reflectors? If you got any information on that thing. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yes, I do, John. I've done a minor amount of study on this exact subject, particularly because I'm the guy who put up 16 long Yagis on 432 in one great big array back in 1978. He used it for 4 years to talk 480 miles sideband on 432 every Tuesday night, talking to K4CAW. What I discovered is that almost every antenna manufacturer mounts the U-bolt on the Yagi closer to the rear end at what he thinks is going to become the gravity balancing point. He knows that some people are going to use a pretty heavy piece of transmission line going from the mast along the boom toward the driven element near the back, and he wants the antenna to be quasi-gravity balanced. What this does 95% of the time is that in physical length of boom, there's almost always a significant more length of boom in front of the mast than behind the mast. Therefore, almost all Yagis, particularly all long Yagis, in a heavy, windy day, will aim themselves downwind. And that's a huge disadvantage. Let me drop them. Unless you have the most humongous rotator in the world, when your antenna is aimed to the north and the wind is blowing from the west, and you've got a lot more boom out in front to the north than you do to the south, that antenna is going to supply a huge amount of torque, and it's cyclic torque as the wind comes in gusts, where it's going to try to twist that antenna clockwise toward east. Eventually, it's going to grind up the gears on your rotator. Eventually, it's going to scuff up the marks where the U-bolts go around the mast, and some terrible things happen. So I have been advocating for a long time that with very simple procedures, without remounting the U-bolt, you can easily wind balance your antenna. In the case of a horizontally polarized Yagi, any vertical piece of sheet metal you place flat against the boom, maybe behind the reflector, maybe even parallel with the reflector, any vertical piece of sheet metal you place is completely at right angles to all of the E-field, the horizontal E-field emitted by that antenna. Therefore, radio-wise, you've done nothing. But now you choose a vertical piece of sheet metal, maybe 1 square foot, maybe 2 square feet, and you mount it at the back end of the Yagi antenna. And if you choose the right length, the right area of that piece of sheet metal, you can now make the antenna 100% wind balanced. Now when the antenna is aimed to the north, the extra boom coming out the front toward the north is trying to twist the antenna clockwise toward east, but the extra piece of sheet metal, a flag or wind aerial that you've added to the back, is now trying to twist it counterclockwise toward the west. And if you choose the right balance, which you can do mathematically by experimentation or whatever, you eventually make the antenna wind neutral. Now the wind can blow as hard as it wants from the west when the antenna is aimed to the north, and you ask the antenna rotator to rotate the antenna clockwise or counterclockwise, it moves very easily as if no wind is blowing. And why we don't do that more often is amazing to me. It's a well-kept secret. I've tried supplying quickie notes to various magazines on this one, and for whatever reason, it didn't get printed. People thought it wasn't important, and I strongly disagree on this one. Let me drop. The most ridiculous case is that amateur in Japan, that very rich man who's got a 5-element, full-size, 80-meter beam mounted on the top of this great big apartment building in Japan. And he has, on multiple occasions, ground up the biggest rotators he can find on that antenna, and he grinds up rotators. I mailed him an email telling him, hey, all you've got to do is a little bit of wind balancing, and all that problem will go away. Maybe there was a language barrier. Maybe there's an understanding barrier. I got no reply. He's made no change. He's still grinding up rotators. So this is a fixable problem if once you understand the physics of what's going on. Wind balancing is not rocket science. We can all do it. KC2WGB, K2LIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yes. I assume from what you're saying, it's like installing a rudder back of that antenna, which would be a broadside rudder, and that would exhibit the same amount of pressure as what is being collected on the forward part of the boom. That's an excellent idea, and I'm surprised that hasn't been thought of and been actually the manufacturers of those antennas should be doing exactly what you recommended. Yeah, good stuff. All right. Well, I was wondering because I didn't know why they do that. It doesn't sound correct to me. It's silly. I know that the rear elements of the Yagi antenna offer more wind loading, and I thought possibly that's why they located back there, but it just doesn't seem to make any sense. All right, let me drop it, and I'll go on to the next one.
I'm going to add a couple words on this one. The elements near the back of the Yagi are stacked much closer together. There's a more mass concentration back there. That's one of the motivations to move the mounting bracket closer to the rear of the antenna. Also, you're about to put, in some cases, a fairly heavy transmission line that goes back there that's going to add extra weight. The wind load of the elements is relatively minor because the wind, in the worst case, is hitting them end-on where they have the minimum area. The area of the boom is the main thing that's creating the wind imbalance or the wind twist to the antenna. So that's the main thing that's got to be corrected. And almost all antennas, Yagi-like, long boom Yagis, have got more boom length in front of the mast than behind the mast for gravity reasons, I think. Also, they've got to mount the mast in a place where the spacing between the elements is reasonable, because if the person's going to use a 2, 2.5, or 3-inch diameter mast, and if he's going to put it in the vicinity of the Yagi where the elements are very closely spaced, like the first couple of directors or between the director and driven element, if you are going to mount a very large diameter mast there, let me drop it. Because of the horizontal width of that large diameter mast, you would be doing some detuning of those local parasitic elements. You would also be making a minor change to the coupling coefficient between the elements. To some degree, you're changing the Yagi design. So where they're going to mount the mast has a number of... where they're going to put the U-bolt has a number of constraints. The best of all possible worlds, it would be a place that gives you wind balance, gravity balance, and it's far away from the elements simultaneously. On most Yagi designs, you don't have all those freedoms. Mother Nature doesn't give you that many things that come out just right, if you know what I mean. Murphy's Law and Elmer's Law is going to strike you. And to repeat, what is Elmer's Law? Elmer's Law states that Murphy was an optimist, the real world's a little worse. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
Yeah, that's a fun setup. Elmer's Law strikes me all the time. All right. The next question up is on directional coupler. Let it drop. All right, I have a gentleman here that has a dual directional coupler with 10 dB sampling ports. Now his question is, he put 0 dBm into this device with a 50 ohm load on the output, and he sampled individual 10 dB ports, and he noticed exactly 10 dB when he did that. Now he wants to know, is it supposed to be exactly the same results on both the reflected port and the directed port when he reverses it, when he puts the signal into the output of the coupler and the dummy load at the input of the coupler? Should the position and the readings just simply reverse, but they should be identical? That's basically his question. If you need any more fill on that, just let me know. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of a dual directional coupler, where you're trying to measure where there's a pair of ports claiming to be a minus 10 dB coupling coefficient, one favors the forward direction, one favors the reverse direction. This is a really ideal directional coupler, and it claims to be 10 dB. Put it up into a laboratory piece of test equipment, and you measure the coupling coefficient, and you'll measure something very close to 10.0 dB on the forward coupler. The reverse coupler, you'll measure very close to minus infinity in dB, no signal at all. And you reverse the whole damn directional coupler and repeat the test, and the numbers will change. In other words, the one that was minus infinity becomes minus 10, the one that was minus 10 becomes minus infinity. would get those measurements if and only if your directional coupler was extremely well balanced, therefore it had very high directivity, and even if it had very high directivity, you would not see that high directivity unless the dummy load you put on the output of the straight-through line of the directional coupler was an extremely high-quality dummy load. Let me drop. If your particular 50-ohm dummy load on the output of the coupler, when you're feeding the signal generator on the input, and hopefully the signal generator has also got a 10 dB pad so that the less than ideal impedance of the signal generator is not contributing to the grief. If you had, let me pick a number, a 1.4 standing wave ratio dummy load at the output end, that means the signal reflected from your dummy load will be, let me pick a number, 18 dB down. That 18 dB down going into the reverse port, where you're trying to measure directivity and you expect the answer to be minus infinity in dBs, and you measure minus 18, you would easily come to the conclusion that, hey, this directional coupler doesn't have very much directivity. The way you do the test can easily give you a failure. In order for the test to give you great results, you need an extremely good dummy load, properly connected with good connectors, a good signal generator, and the right kind of instrumentation, and a well-balanced directional coupler. Now let me show you one further level of complication that can take place. Let's assume that your directional coupler was built with mediocre, good enough engineering performance, where its directivity of all of its ports was 18 dB of directivity. Ideal would be infinite dB of directivity, but it's got 18 dB of directivity. And let's assume that your dummy load has got a 1.3 or 1.2 standing wave ratio, which means it's creating a signal of minus 18 dBm. And you're trying to measure directivity of the reverse port during this particular test. So the reverse port, if the dummy load was perfect and the coupler was perfect, you'd expect to see minus infinity dB. And because your coupler's directivity is minus 18, and because the signal reflected from the dummy load is minus 18 dB relative, a pair of minus 18s mixed together, if the length of cable going to the dummy load just happens to be the right length of cable, so those two signals are out of phase with each other, the minus 18 directivity of the coupler, the minus 18 dB of reflection of your dummy load could give you a perfect cancellation, and you measure minus infinity, and you say to yourself, boy, I've got the best coupler in the world. And you add an extra quarter wavelength of cable between the output end of that coupler and that less than ideal dummy load, the minus 18 and the minus 18 mix together in phase, and when you add voltages in phase, you get twice the voltage, you get a 6 dB increase, so the real minus 18 dB of the coupler will look like minus 12. You will measure minus 12 in that environment. So you can see that measuring a directional coupler, making a judgment of how good it is and how accurate it is in coupling coefficient and directivity, there's only 10 ways you can come up with pretty erroneous data. It takes a fair amount of
Repeater, timeout.
It takes a fair amount of understanding of what's going on. When in doubt, if you had a very well-equipped laboratory, on the output end of the directional coupler, you would put a trombone device, a well-made general radio trombone device. So therefore, the length of line between the output of your coupler and your supposedly known good dummy load, you can operate that trombone, and you can make that length of line go from quarter wave to half wave to three-quarter waves and so on. What you're doing with that trombone is you're taking any possible reflection coefficient from your dummy load, because it's less than ideal, you're reflecting it back to the coupler, to that reverse port, and at certain settings of that trombone, those two signals are in phase, and at certain settings of the trombone, they're out of phase. Therefore, you watch the amount of wiggle on the signal you measure on that reverse directional port. If the test was ideal, you operate the trombone, the signal doesn't move. Sits at minus 18 and doesn't change. That's if your dummy load is perfect and your trombone is perfect. The amount of wiggle you get, the peak to valley, in the example I just gave you, you would go from minus 12 to minus infinity as you operated that trombone. And if you know what you're looking at, you take those two numbers and you put them together and you can do a calculation as to what is the real directivity and what is the real quality of your dummy load. Let me drop. A guy named K2LIW wrote an article on just this procedure. You can easily get a copy of that article in your hand on your screen by going to Mike Number 2's website. That's the one that's limogtechnet.com. And you go to the articles by K2LIW, and there's an article there telling you how to use directional couplers and how to calibrate them when used for visual and power measurement. Article's a little bit long, but it goes through these details. So measuring a directional coupler, there's quite a bit of art and science to that one, as you can see. And there's a lot more to the story, but you've gotten some of the headlines. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB, yes, you can spend a lot of time just trying to understand how they operate. I agree. Yes, and he's having a lot of fun with this. He spent a lot of time working on it. Now, I have another question that goes right along with directional couplers from another gentleman who has a directional coupler. Let me let it drop. He has a directional coupler. He is operating within its frequency range, and he has found something he doesn't understand. He believes that if he connects his generator, again, he's 0 dBm in, and at his sample port, with nothing connected on the other end of the coupler, he's reading that frequency at minus 10 dB. Okay, fine. When he connects a dummy load on it, a good certified dummy load, he notices very little change, only about a tenth or two-tenths of a dB, maximum. And he wants to know if the dummy load is supposed to be absorbing all of that energy. Where is the reflection coming from? Why is he getting a signal out of that sample port? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
That's a rather good measurement, John. If I'm using a medium good quality directional coupler, and I'm looking at the forward coupled directional port, minus 10 dB, it's rated minus 10 dB at this particular frequency, and I'm using it at that frequency. And if and only if the signal generator is a pure 50 ohm source, to get near 0 dBm, which is near the top of many signal generators, with the amount of attenuation coming out of the final amplifier of the signal generator, starting to get the small numbers, there are some signal generators where at the 0 dBm setting, they have a output standing wave ratio that might be 1.2, like 1.3. It's not a pure 50 ohm load, a 50 ohm source. Now, when that directional coupler is, let me first start off with an ideal signal generator. I got a signal generator that just happens to be 50.00 ohms of source impedance. By the way, I get there by putting a 20 decibel attenuator of high quality after the signal generator, no matter what the standing wave ratio of the signal generator is. After a 20 dB attenuator of high quality made by Wenchel, for instance, the worst reflection coefficient you could get out of that signal generator is minus 40, 20 dB twice. You've added a 20 dB pad. So I can force my signal generator to be the highest quality in the world in output impedance if I use a high quality attenuator of enough decibels after it. Let's assume I've done that. And I've now measured the forward signal, in this case, a 10 dB coupling coefficient. And all the signal goes roaring through the directional coupler, sees the open circuit at the end, and flicks. Because it's an open circuit, 99...
Repeater, timeout.
Because it's an open circuit, 99.9% of it is going to reflect from the output, and all that reflected energy is going to go back toward the signal generator. The signal generator, in my example, is such a beautiful 50 ohm source that all of that reflected energy is absorbed at the signal generator as if it was a perfect dummy load, even though it's a source of signal of the exact same frequency. Some of those electrons on the previous cycles are coming back and they all get absorbed. In this ideal situation, the forward coupled port will measure 10 dB down and with and without an ideal dummy load or a bad dummy load at the far end. You're only changing the amount of signal coming back from the far end. Either it gets absorbed with a good dummy load or all of it reflects. Because you're looking at the forward port, and if the forward port has high enough directivity, it will see no change. It's only measuring forward power. You haven't changed the amount of forward power because you did or didn't put a dummy load at the far end. The dummy load at the far end tells you how much reflection is going to take place from the far end. It doesn't change the forward power. Therefore, you'll see no wiggle as you add and subtract any dummy load, any bad load, whatever at the far end. A short circuit with a trombone would be the most severe test. Let me drop.
Nick, you don't let it drop long enough when you time out. You're blowing it off.
Sorry about that. I'm going to let it time out right now. Do you have reason to believe I'm all reset? By the way, when I go and listen to a 375 and it's in full operation, does that mean we're probably okay, or are there other things that I'm not monitoring that could be in the hang-up mode, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, you have a habit of listening to what's going on with the repeater, so as soon as you can key it up, you try to key it up, even before it's released, the other stuff that you're not listening to, 375, by the way, used to be a big problem, no longer a problem. It's going to follow things rather quickly. So if you hear it there, chances are you didn't wait long enough for the other stuff. Remember, the ILP needs a minimum of 4 seconds. You don't give it that much.
Guilty as charged. Eric, for the monitoring that you're able to do right now, is everything reset, or are some of the people out there on IRLP or Echolink being denied? Over to you, Eric.
I noticed some of the IRLP things dropped out, so whether or not they reconnected. That's what happened, you know. So you're the one that actually causes most of the problems. You talk, when you're in this part of the thing, you talk until you can't talk anymore. Then the instant that you can start talking, you do. So, it's not long enough.
I hear you. So, Eric, are you telling me that I'm long-winded and I'm jumping the gun on the resetting of the machine? Is that what you're saying, Eric?
You're inebriated with your verbosity.
This counts the number of times the machine goes time out.
Now, I think I've only timed it out about 6 or 7 times tonight. you're right. I'm beginning to see the error of my ways. Now, if this coupler is ideal enough and you change the load at the output end while monitoring the forward port, nothing will change because the forward power didn't change. But now let me show you some of the things that will make the forward power change. All of the power you're sending down the coupler when it's into an open circuit, by definition, because there's a pure open circuit at the end, all of it's reflecting back toward the signal generator. Even if the forward coupler had high directivity and thoroughly ignored the power coming back, that power coming back to the signal generator, if the signal generator is not a pure 50-ohm source / dummy load 50 ohms, then some of the signal hitting the signal generator re-reflects forward. It's added to the signal generator is being creating right now. And those two voltages now going forward either add in phase, out of phase, or something in between. Therefore, the true forward power does change, and the forward directional coupler will show you some change as you add. Go ahead, Eric. reflected back to the signal generator can get re-reflected forward. Somewhat similar to what happens in the case of a antenna tuner being used with a fairly high standard wave ratio antenna. You put your directional power meter, your watt meter, on the output end of the antenna tuner. You know your signal, your transmitter can only create 100 watts, but you might measure 50 watts coming back and 150 watts going forward. And at first it'll drive you up a wall, but the 150 watts going forward can be real. There are a number of people who make the mistake of thinking that because an antenna tuner can correct standing wave ratio from the transmitter's point of view, they assume it is also correcting standing wave ratio on the output end of the antenna tuner. They assume that the transmission line and antenna no longer has any visual. Absolutely not. Let me drop. If your transmission line plus antenna has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, no matter what you do in the shack, that transmission line to antenna interface will never have anything but a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio in this example. The antenna tuner takes that reflected power from the antenna, roughly 10 dB down, re-reflects it forward, if it's a 2-to-1 this one, and you'll see greater than normal power going forward. So your directional coupler can also be seeing that exact thing if your signal generator is not a pure 50 ohm load. Now you go to the next step beyond that, where you've got less than an ideal dummy load, less than an ideal signal generator, and less than ideal directivity of that directional forward-looking port. Depending on lengths of cable between signal generator and coupler, depending on lengths of cable between coupler and dummy load, you can now make some considerable wiggles. That minus 10 dB signal can easily go from minus 9 to minus 11 as you change those cable lengths. And the system is all doing that because of these crazy reflections going on. And the signal reflected from the signal generator gets added to the signal being generated by the signal generator. The signal reflected from the dummy load goes into the back end of the directional coupler that has less than diurial directivity, and therefore it's responding to some of the signal going in the wrong direction. So all of these signals at that directional port, let me drop. All of those signals at the directional port can be adding in phase, out of phase, in quadrature, and so on, and you'll get wiggles. And if you're smart enough to use a trombone or some other kind of line length changing device in those various locations, and you measure the average and the peak to valley of what you see on the minus 10 dB port, you can, by way of that article on Mike number 2's website, I'm on technet.com, you'll get a further understanding of what's taking place. I gave a real working example in that article to show you can have these crazy measurements. You can now, by way of that article, figure out what is going on, and you can find out exactly how much power really is coming back from your antenna, even though you have less than ideal measurement conditions. There's ways you can straighten this all out. It's not too complicated. I didn't say it's super easy. The article, some people think the article goes a long way to clearing this jazz up. Directional couplers, let me drop. Directional couplers are not rocket science. If you know what you're doing, and you've got a transmitter, and you want to put a brand new meter on the front panel, or you've got a rotary switch, and you want one of those switch positions to give you relative power output of your transmitter, and another switch position, relative power reflected from the antenna back to the transmitter, and you'd like to have a directional coupler there, you could go out and buy a real directional coupler, install it outside of the transmitter, and wire it properly with detectors and so on. If you know what you're doing, you take a simple loop of wire, place it near the output SO239 connector of the transmitter, a simple loop of wire, maybe a half inch in diameter, placed near the output center conductor of the SO239, with the right kind of a terminating resistor on that loop of wire and a diode detector, you can now make a high directivity sampler on at least one of those frequencies that the transmitter operates on, rectify that signal, sending it to the meter on the front panel, and you get a beautiful indication of power output, relative power output, real power output, and reflected power. It's not rocket science. A simple loop of wire, properly used, can make a homebrew directional coupler. My article on the stripline parallel kilowatt amplifier indicated one of those ways of doing that. That was April and May 1972, QST, way back in the dark ages. That's the stripline parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432. So, learning how a directional coupler works, let me drop. In my opinion, it's a very worthwhile thing. It's a very inexpensive, high-performance piece of instrumentation, thoroughly passive, no expensive parts in there. To understand how it works is a very worthy thing to do. The courses in electrical engineering do not cover that subject. I know of no book that does a good job of covering that subject. They throw you a bunch of Maxwell's equations, they make it sound like it's very complicated. It doesn't have to be that way. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
K2WGB. Yes, they are very interesting, and there is a lot of information. The only thing wrong with... Actually, you've got to do something kind of silly. They're easy to work with, and you can get some great readings from them. One other question, which he didn't really ask, but I want you to cover if you can, is now, you understood the test he made. Now, we want to reverse the input and output, as we did in the other discussion. What should he see at that same sample port? He was reading approximately minus 10 dB. It was like 10.8, and it only changed like 10.6 when he put the load on it. Now, if he reverses the input and the output, what is he going to see at the sample port there? Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, there's a slight sampling, there's a slight ambiguity in what you said, John. You said the sampling port. I think you mean the forward direction sampling port versus the reverse direction sampling port. The so-called forward direction sampling port, when you take the whole non-directional coupler and reverse main input and output connector, it now turns it around backwards. The so-called forward sampling directional port now becomes the reverse coupling sampling port. And so how much power reflects from the dummy load now becomes very important.
Just to make it clear, he only has one sampling port on this device.
Okay, that one sampling port has an arrow on it indicating which direction it is sampling power. A sampling port on a directional coupler is not a dumb sampler like you've got on a slotted line. The slotted line has a probe that tells you what's the total voltage on the center conductor, where it adds together forward propagating power and reverse propagating power. And at some positions on that sliding carriage of that probe of a slotted line, you'll see a peak and valley. Peak in voltage at some other point, a quarter wavelength away, you see a valley in voltage, and the ratio between the two is called standing wave ratio. That particular probe is a non-directional probe. Let me drop. By definition, if you're using a directional coupler, it is in theory only looking at the signal that flows in one particular direction. And that coupled port has an arrow indicating which direction it's got an arrow or diagram telling you which direction.